Today on Against the Grain, what has been the relationship between queer struggles and other struggles on the left against racism, imperialism, and war? It's often assumed that gay and lesbian liberation has run on its own separate track, but my guest today argues that that's a misconception. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with historian Emily Hobson about LGBTQ liberation and the politics of solidarity, including with people resisting U.S. intervention in Central America. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Much of what we could call queer politics today is so thoroughly mainstream that for many people, it's hard to imagine that the roots of LGBTQ politics have been radical roots. And if it's imagined, it's still assumed that queer people have worked for gay liberation as a self-contained project, an identity project, not tied to movements against war, racism, and other oppressions. Emily Hobson is Assistant Professor of History and of Gender, Race, and Identity at the University of Nevada, Reno. In her book, Lavender and Red, Liberation and Solidarity in the Gay and Lesbian Left, published by the University of California Press, she looks at the history of struggles by people who identified as gay and lesbian, especially in the San Francisco Bay Area. Emily, why do you think we should rethink the assumption that queer struggles have taken place more or less separately from anti-racism and anti-war struggles, among others?
One reason would be that we can't tell the history without looking at how gay liberation and lesbian feminism were intertwined with other surrounding movements, particularly the anti-Vietnam War movement, Black Power, feminism more broadly, and also by the late 1970s and 1980s, the Central American Solidarity Movement, and other kinds of causes. So we really can't explain the breadth of gay and lesbian community. We can't understand the references, for example, of who go back and look at, theater productions or gay and lesbian newspapers, the kinds of things they were writing about. If you step back into the archives without a kind of appreciation of the broad breadth of social movement engagement that gay and lesbian activists were part of, you're kind of lost if you don't sort of look around and notice that those other kinds of issues were intertwined with sexual politics.
Is there any danger in looking back that these histories are not being preserved? I mean, given that there's a lot of gay politics that today is quite mainstream, that the history itself tends to be told through a more liberal lens?
Absolutely. I mean, and I think one of the things that happens with this loss of the sort of sense of radical history and a loss of a sense of interconnection is that contemporary activists, especially younger LGBTQ activists who are searching for ways to think about sexuality and gender in intersection with race and in intersection with empire and issues around immigration and so forth, they imagine that they're kind of creating things from scratch because they have no sense of anything that has come before, right? They sort of imagine that, as you said, there's a gay and lesbian politics that existed before that was kind of unto itself, as if sexuality could be totally separated from other issues, and that they are the first people to be trying to think about the intersections with other kinds of concerns. So they feel kind of cut off from a sense of their own history, a sense of their own past, which is so detrimental to both the lessons they could draw out of the past and just the arguments they can make about the validity of a kind of intersectional approach. So that's another kind of thing that gets lost, right, is that people's sense today of why a kind of more multi-issue radical history might help propel them forward.
Well, you argue that radical gay liberation was a product of the new left. But I wonder if, in the interest of taking the intersection of gay liberation and radical politics before Stonewall, the 1969 Stonewall riots, which are seen as this landmark moment in the history of gay liberation. Can you tell us about the prehistory of gay liberation in the old left?
You know, the what we think of as the kind of expansion of LGBTQ organizing really takes off after World War II. And it begins, interestingly enough, kind of out of both liberal and more leftist impulses. The more leftist impulse comes out of activists who are trying to think about how to start organizing as gay men and lesbians, and really to, you know, what are they going to draw on as their model for organizing in this way, since they don't really have much to look back to. And so the Mattachine Society in particular, which is the first kind of organization, gay rights organization, that has any real longevity, which is founded in 1950 in large part by Harry Hay. Hay had been a member of the Communist Party. He resigned from the party in order to found Mattachine, basically out of kind of respect for the party's rule against homosexual members, so kind of respect slash strategic kind of self-removal from the party. But he borrowed on communist thought to conceptualize gay people as a kind of cultural minority, akin to other cultural minorities that could organize in their own interest. So there were these two kinds of impulses, one the kind of inclusion and citizenship, and the other looking to the left as the source of models for organizing. Pretty quickly, what we call the homophile movement, which is the sort of early phase of gay and lesbian organizing in the 1950s and early 1960s, moved away from the more explicitly left sources towards the more kind of, you know, liberal strategies of working in the courts, working on issues of sexual privacy, against censorship, and kind of less bent on kind of a left ideology around sexuality. The other reason that I think we can argue that there was this move slightly away from the left in the homophile movement was the presence, the real presence of anti-gay sentiment in the broader left at this time, both the kind of the old left and the early new left, the kind of idea that sexuality wasn't really a political concern, and also that the presence of visibly gay and lesbian people in left organizing would only further endanger activists to state surveillance and so forth.
Why has the San Francisco Bay Area been so important for radical queer politics?
So the Bay Area holds a really special place in queer history, of course. And one of the reasons that I focus my book on the Bay Area is, of course, the wealth of material that I could find in archives, and also the kind of rich network of activists that I could speak with in interviews, oral history interviews. I also myself lived in the Bay Area for several years, so those connections were there, and I had the kind of the means to be able to visit those archives more easily. You know, I could, in very simple terms, I could afford the research. That's one of the reasons I focus on the Bay Area, which I like to sort of say because I think it's important to talk about the material reality of historical research as well as the kind of, the aspiration. But one of those things that I really found in focusing on the Bay Area was one of the reasons that I think has been underexplored about its kind of significance in queer history is its very kind of strong links to internationalist politics, and also the strong presence of various immigrant communities made a real difference in some of the alliances and kind of forms of solidarity that gay and lesbian radicals could engage in. So about half of the book looks to some degree at the impact of Central American solidarity work on gay and lesbian radicalism and the involvement of gay and lesbian leftists in Central American solidarity, as well as the kinds of exchanges between Central America work and other kinds of gay and lesbian activism and also AIDS activism. And one of the things I really found was that in some very clear ways, it was in part the kind of neighborhood connections that then, you know, moved out into more kind of internationalist and global connections that helped to solidify that link for gay and lesbian people. So gay and lesbian people in the late 1970s and 1980s were really concerned with Central American solidarity for a number of reasons, and this was true for queer activism across the U.S. So, for example, they were concerned with Central America in part simply because, you know, Reagan was engaged in, you know, intervention in Central America, and Reagan was also attacking gay and lesbian people and feminist concerns, and so there was this notion of a kind of common enemy, right, and a need to stand with people under attack for kind of other reasons. There was also a lot of investment in the Nicaraguan Revolution in particular because of the really strong presence of women as leaders in the Sandinista Revolution. But then also, to kind of bring it back more locally, these links were especially strong in the Bay Area because of the overlap between queer community and Central American and other Latino community, particularly, for example, in San Francisco's Mission District. So as a kind of neighborhood where you could walk down the street and see signs and posters and, you know, engage in protest for multiple kinds of issues. So to a degree, for gay and lesbian people to be involved in Central American solidarity was to be involved in a kind of neighborhood-based internationalism. So that's one of the things that I really found to be unique about the Bay Area's influence, was the way that these international connections played out at the local level.
And of course, the Bay Area was a key place in the New Left in the 60s and the 70s. How did the Stonewall riots, which took place in New York City in 1969, help catalyze a movement of queer liberation, gay liberation in the Bay Area? Or to what degree was that already in process before Stonewall?
It definitely was in process before Stonewall. So, for example, the Compton's Cafeteria riot took place in San Francisco in August of 1966, and it is increasingly described as a kind of important forerunner event to Stonewall. Susan Stryker, a really wonderful historian, has especially done a lot to raise the profile of kind of our knowledge of the Compton's Cafeteria riot.
Tell us what it was.
This was an uprising that took place in the Tenderloin, San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood, in August of 1966 at an all-night cafeteria called Compton's Cafeteria. It was one of a small chain. And the Compton's Cafeteria location in the Tenderloin was a site where a number of drag queens and trans women would congregate and, you know, hang out, have coffee, you know, eat food, etc., but also a site where they were frequently harassed by police. And one particular night in August of 1966, this harassment took place, and one of the queens fought back, and it became a slightly larger rebellion in which the police were kind of pushed out of Compton's. And it also was an event that, after it, some of the local activists who had already been working on queer and trans concerns in the Tenderloin kind of used the moment of Compton's to push for, better treatment from the city, more social services. And one of the reasons that I think it's important to look at Compton's is to kind of recognize that although it's not as well known as Stonewall, although it didn't last as long as the Stonewall riots, which were sustained over two nights in Greenwich Village, although it has taken more to kind of raise its profile as a historical event, it indicates the kind of everyday resistance that people were engaged in as queer people, and also the ways that a number of different kinds of activists were starting to look at, harassment of queer people and the kind of situation of gay, lesbian, and trans and bi people as political concerns. So, Stryker really details that really nicely in the documentary Screaming Queens, as well as some of the work she's written work she's done. Definitely, I think it's important to note that a lot of things were going on before Stonewall. the term gay liberation was starting to be used before the Stonewall riots. A number of different, you know, small rebellions had been taking place around the country, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, and other kinds of places. Carl Whitman, who was an activist in SDS, had written an essay called The Gay Manifesto that really used the term gay liberation repeatedly and also pointed to San Francisco as an important site for gay liberation, and that was written and began to circulate a couple months before the Stonewall riots. Stonewall was undoubtedly important, but I think that we often sort of give it a kind of magical importance that doesn't really look at, you know, well, what's the chain of events after it? The two things that are really significant that come out of Stonewall for more sustained organizing are, number one, the formation of the first Gay Liberation Front in New York City, which is formed partly by a few people who are at the Stonewall riots, but also by a larger group of people who most likely weren't there, right, but were inspired by them. The second thing that's really important that comes out of Stonewall is that a year later it begins to be commemorated. So it's the commemoration beginning in June of 1970 that really kind of gives to Stonewall this meaning as a foundational event. But we also have to think about what happened in that year between Stonewall itself and its commemoration. And that's a moment when things really begin to explode all over the country. And then the Gay Liberation Front becomes important there because people in various places around the United States and then increasingly around the world take the model of the Gay Liberation Front and kind of replicate it. So there are a number of organizations that are already existing, gay radical organizations that are already existing around the U.S. before Stonewall, but once the Gay Liberation Front is created and starts to kind of publicize itself through the radical press, a number of different groups around the country kind of switch names and adopt the name of the GLF to make themselves kind of more legible and connect themselves to each other. So we see that happening in the Bay Area. For example, there was a group called the Committee for Homosexual Freedom that I think was very much a gay liberationist organization that was active for several months before Stonewall, but once the GLF had been founded, it renamed itself the San Francisco GLF, and that kind of kept happening. You know, that same pattern happened in a lot of places around the country. So I think Stonewall was important and also has been overblown to some degree, and that what we really need to do when we're looking at the sort of signal importance of Stonewall is to think about how the story is told, really give credit to the trans women of color who were really kind of the key leaders of the rebellion itself, as well as think about how is it that it's been commemorated and how does its commemoration both obscure certain kinds of histories and become itself an interesting thing to track, sort of how is it that radical history helps propel a movement forward.
Indeed. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Emily Hobson. She's assistant professor of history and of gender, race, and identity at the University of Nevada, Reno. And she's the author of Lavender and Red, Liberation and Solidarity in the Gay and Lesbian Left, and that's published by the University of California Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. So at the time that gay liberation comes on the scene, mm-hmm. how did people who were involved in these movements understand their oppression?
So there's a quote early on in the first chapter that comes from one of the sources, you know, kind of early pieces of gay liberation writing that points to, you know, police, military, city hall, capitalism as the kind of key sources of anti-gay oppression. And that kind of analysis really is the root of, you know, gay and lesbian left analysis of what we now call homophobia. Interestingly enough, this is a kind of moment when language is really being invented. So, for example, people don't have the term homophobia initially. They have the term sexism and racism and capitalism and imperialism, and those are the terms that they're using to analyze what they're experiencing as gay and lesbian people. And In fact, many of them really kind of reject the idea that their oppression is about kind of personal bias or personal fears, which is kind of the argument of the language of homophobia. It's a more psychological term, right, that makes an argument about a kind of fear of homosexuality. Gay and lesbian radicals really in the sort of late 1960s, early 1970s are trying to think about how is it that the oppression they're experiencing is really structural. So they turn towards thinking about, you know, why is it that the military wants a certain kind of dominant masculinity and doesn't want, you know, gay men, and why might gay men be able to really affirm gayness and effeminacy as powerful models for rejecting war and militarism? Why is it that police want to attack both the Black Panthers and, you know, gay bars? And why might that be a source of alliance between communities that are often understood as being separate? Why is it that, socialist feminism has something to say to gay liberation and to lesbian feminism about, inequality within the family, sexism within the family, what kinds of jobs are well paid or not, these kinds of concerns, right? So that's one of the things I think is really powerful about the kind of early gay liberation and lesbian feminist moment is the ways that people are looking towards structural explanations and that point them towards radical solidarities. Because once you begin to look and see structural explanations for problems, you can no longer think that your goal is only to change attitudes about kind of one narrow slice of identity. You really have to think about solidarity with other kinds of groups.
And what did that look like in practice in the 1970s, in the 1980s?
So by the about 1973, 1974, the movement against the Vietnam War is kind of drawing down as the war does, and the gay and lesbian left also begins to move in new kinds of directions. There's a kind of searching around for other sites of international solidarity because a kind of anti-war sentiment has been really important to gay and lesbian organizing already. And so there's a quick turn towards Latin American solidarity as a really important site. Again, in part because U.S. intervention moves more clearly to Latin America, but also because of the ways that this helps to forge more immediate and local kinds of alliances. So this first shows up through some work around Chile in the aftermath of the CIA-backed coup against Allende in Chile. So there's some Chilean solidarity work that gay and lesbian radicals are involved in. And then by the late 1970s, very clearly is concentrated around Central America and especially Nicaragua. Another place that you really start to see a kind of shift in and growth of the gay and lesbian left is kind of a critique of the economy and a growth of gay labor alliances. And this is also a site where some more liberal activists are also engaged, and so it's a kind of site of both kind of left and sort of liberal left mobilization that also provides some of the groundwork for the organizing against Proposition 6 in California, the Briggs Initiative, which sought to deny the right of gay and lesbian teachers, as well as any other teachers who supported gay and lesbian rights, to be in the classroom. We often describe the movement against Prop 6, which is often referred to as the Briggs Initiative, as, you know, primarily just a pushback against the rhetoric of gay and lesbian people as child molesters and so on, which it was very importantly also that. But I think, you know, when we really kind of peel back the history, we see the ways that a lot of the very powerful kind of on-the-ground organizing allegiances that helped to defeat Prop 6 were really gay labor alliances that had begun, for example, in San Francisco with the Gay Teachers Campaign in 1975, which Tom Almiano, who was then a teacher in the district, was a really prominent activist within. So we have international solidarity kind of moving over to Latin America. We have gay labor alliances. And then we also have a kind of crystallizing opposition to state violence and a kind of support for the radical underground, which is particularly important for lesbian feminists in the mid-1970s, and which a lot of lesbian feminists who are sort of supporting women in the radical underground, including, for example, Susan Sachs, who by 1975 was arrested but also came out as a lesbian, they're linking that support for figures in the radical underground to their work against rape and on behalf of women who are making arguments for self-defense against rape. So the Inez Garcia case, the Joanne Little case, there's a kind of connection that lesbian feminists are drawing between Inez Garcia, Susan Sachs, Joanne Little, and other kinds of figures as all women who are resisting state violence and who are arguing for a different kind of, you know, defense against violence, which I refer to as collective defense.
What role does an awareness of race play in these movements? I mean, you write about them as not exclusively white, but certainly a lot of the gay and lesbian left was populated by white people. How did its orientation towards multiracial alliances play out, and what were the kind of complex politics of race in these alliances?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the ways that I think the gay and lesbian left begins to kind of coalesce in the very early 1970s in ways that kind of distinguishes it from a broader strand of gay liberation is actually a critique of very simplistic approaches to race. So, for example, there's a kind of early impulse in gay liberation to compare sexuality and race as analogous. Right? So, you know, racism is a problem and this anti-gay oppression is like racism. You know, race is a category that needs to be understood and sexuality is like race. So there's a lot of kind of very simple analogies. And very quickly, more kind of leftist gay and lesbian activists start, and also a lot of gay and lesbian people of color begin to argue, you know, this, you can't just say they're analogous. They're not exactly parallel. They overlap. They shape each other. Race already, you know, racism already works through assumptions about sexuality. Sexuality already, you know, operates in part through concerns around race and reproduction and so on. So they are not analogous. They are intersecting, as we would say now. And also, to imagine that they are parallel assumes or sort of tends to propel the idea that gay equals white and people of color equals straight, right? So, which leaves gay and lesbian people of color kind of invisible. So there's an early kind of critique of that kind of impulse, and that's something that continues to be repeated and sustained for decades. It's interesting to me that, you know, no matter how often it's been voiced, the sort of idea that sexuality and race are parallel kind of continues to reemerge, to sort of reassert itself like a zombie. But, you know, we kind of see that constantly being critiqued repeatedly by kind of successive waves of gay and lesbian radicals, both white and of color. And another thing that really kind of emerges is that out of this sort of desire for radical solidarity, there's also a kind of risk of romanticism, right? Of kind of, especially from primarily white gay and lesbian radicals, romanticizing sites that are conceived of as the third world. And one of the ways that queer people of color really push back against that kind of romanticism or exotification is by, again, asserting themselves as different kinds of subjects or sort of agents of solidarity. So a really important example of that comes out in the mid-1980s through the Victoria Mercado Brigade, which was the first explicitly gay and lesbian brigade to Nicaragua, and which was a majority people of color, especially women of color group, and really kind of used its identity as a mostly women of color group to argue that solidarity with Nicaragua and with Central America more broadly was a kind of transnational feminism, right, that could be led by a kind of women of color analysis.
That is Emily Hobson. She's an historian and author of Lavender and Red. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So tell us more about the Central America solidarity work and the multiracial alliances that were made with the gay and lesbian community in the San Francisco Bay Area. For listeners outside of the Bay Area, especially the Mission District in San Francisco, was a place where a lot of people who had been involved in or were supportive of revolutionary movements, especially in Nicaragua, were living. There was also actually a significant number of people also from the right, Nicaragua, who also lived in the Bay Area. But what sort of alliances were built, and especially what was the role of people, and you've touched on this when you were talking about the brigade, who were Central American and gay?
The Nicaraguan solidarity movement in particular really kind of emerges first in the U.S., strongly in the Bay Area, and also to a lesser extent in Washington, D.C. Those are two sites where some of the first Nicaraguan solidarity groups are created and become active. And they actually begin to become active really after 1972. There's a major, major earthquake in Managua, and international aid that is sent to the country is kind of siphoned off by the Somoza dictatorship that's ruling the country, and that, you know, against which leftists of various stripes in Nicaragua are, and also kind of Nicaraguan exiles, are organizing against. So there's a kind of scandal as these revelations about the kind of misuse of aid for the earthquake come in, and that helps to propel a real sharp uptick in international and transnational solidarity work with and alongside the growing Sandinista movement against Somoza. And so the Bay Area becomes an important kind of outpost of this among both Nicaraguan and non-Nicaraguan Latino and Latin American immigrant leaders. And initially this is, you know, really kind of rooted in Nicaraguan and more broadly Latino community. It's not particularly, you know, gay or lesbian, but because, again, of its kind of neighborhood basis, a number of people who are gay or lesbian and who are kind of, you know, friends with, comrades with, their kind of surrounding neighbors, begin to slowly become involved. And one of the things that I try to track, I mean, I thought for a while, like, do I want to be writing a book that is a history or a sort of separate project, perhaps another book that is about gay and lesbian involvement in Central American solidarity work, right? It's just about participation in a broader movement. But over time, I started to see that although there's a certainly an interesting story to tell, I think, just about participation in the broader movement, that pretty early on, there were gay and lesbian activists who were beginning to organize specifically gay and lesbian solidarity groups. And they did so in part to push other gay and lesbian people to care more about Central America, right? So instead of only becoming involved in Central American solidarity work because they cared about that issue, or they were connected, or they were themselves Nicaraguan, or they were themselves Latino, they also were attempting to form specifically gay and lesbian solidarity groups to both make themselves visible as queer people in solidarity work and to push other queer people to see this solidarity as an important issue to gay and lesbian people. And there were a number of kind of important bridge figures who kind of crossed back and forth between the broader Nicaraguan solidarity work and gay and lesbian community. So, for example, Roberto Gordian and Rita Raus were two people who were Nicaraguan-born, living in San Francisco, who performed that kind of bridge work. Gordian was gay, Raus was lesbian, and they were also quite vocal within, for example, gay and lesbian press outlets, right? So Gordian was interviewed in what was then called Coming Up, a gay newspaper in San Francisco, by Aurora Levins Morales, who's an important Puerto Rican and Jewish lesbian feminist, really kind of with a national and international stature. So, you know, there would be these sort of individual bridge figures who would then kind of ensure to sort of use the platform of the gay and lesbian press to kind of broadcast the importance of these interconnections and to make arguments about, you know, building more multiracial gay and lesbian community, fighting the right together on multiple fronts, these kinds of arguments. We also started to see ways that primarily white groups attempted very consciously to build more clear connections with primarily straight Central American groups. So primarily white gay and lesbian groups with primarily straight Central American groups. So for example, the first sustained organization called Gay People for the Nicaraguan Revolution, in which Roberto Gurdian was involved, was largely white, but through Gurdian, it got its mail ad and made connections with a broader organization called Casa Nicaragua, which was a mostly Nicaraguan and organization and mostly straight, of course. And, you know, so it would help out at meetings by providing child care to Casa Nicaragua's parents who wanted to be able to participate in meetings. It held a kind of session for Casa Nicaragua on gay and lesbian politics and kind of why gay and lesbian people would care about Central American solidarity. So there were a lot of sort of efforts at kind of educational sessions, discussions to explain the kind of connections that people were drawing. And through those kind of connections, one of the things we see is just really strong relationships, person-to-person relationships, that helps to foster the kinds of interconnections that people were arguing about kind of more ideologically.
How did people within the Bay Area gay and lesbian left deal with homophobia coming from the rest of the radical left in the Bay Area?
One of the things we see kind of early in the gay liberation moment is a kind of, if not hostility, then dismissal from other radicals, ostensibly straight, you know, kind of leftists. So that's something that gay and lesbian radicals have to push back against, certainly, you know, at the moment of the emergence of gay liberation and also of lesbian feminism, a kind of argument that gay and lesbian issues aren't really political, they don't really matter, they are, you know, at the worst, kind of bourgeois and decadent, right? Those are the kinds of arguments that gay and lesbian radicals have to argue against. And one of the kinds of problems that propels them to argue about the interconnections between sexuality and racism, capitalism, militarism, and so forth. By the mid to late 1970s, you start to see a fair amount of turnaround from a lot of straight leftists, particularly because of and sort of in response to the forms of solidarity that gay and lesbian leftists have been engaging in, right? So as gay and lesbian leftists really make themselves visible and show up on various kinds of issues, it really certainly helps to change a lot of minds and helps a lot of sort of straight leftists who are uncomfortable with issues of homosexuality start to kind of reconsider. They, of course, begin to know gay and lesbian people, and this kind of helps to change attitudes. One of the interesting things, though, that shows up is that even though hostility lessens and even the kind of dismissal lessens, there's a growing acceptance that gay and lesbian issues are truly political issues. There's still a sort of a notion that that gay and lesbian people sort of simply aren't interested in broader concerns. So by 1988, there's a moment in March of 1988 when President Reagan sends troops to Honduras. He's sort of threatening an invasion of Nicaragua. There's 10 days of major protests all over the United States, including in San Francisco, and gay and lesbian people are very prominent in those anti-war protests. And what's interesting is that gay and lesbian people are quite prominent in these protests. They get a lot of coverage, including from like the San Francisco Chronicle and major news outlets, but there's a note of surprise in that coverage. A kind of, why are gay and lesbian people involved in Central American solidarity? Why are they involved in anti-war work? And gay and lesbian radicals themselves say, look, we've been active in this for decades now. We've been quite prominent. And if you didn't know we were here, you know, you just weren't paying attention, right, is the one of the direct lines from one of the activists who I cite talking about this. So it's an interesting kind of shift from outright hostility to a kind of, you know, inability to see gay and lesbian radicalism that is kind of all around. And I think that that marks a real change, right? Because by the late 1980s, there's again, much less hostility to gay and lesbian issues from straight people. But there's also still this problem of kind of not being able to see gay and lesbian radicalism. And I'm hoping that the book helps people to see what was always there, right? Because there is a way, of course, that although there are many ways that queer people are quite, make themselves quite visible, right, in gender performance, in kind of the ways they talk about sexuality, there's also a way that, people can sort of turn their heads and sort of, you know, look away and imagine that they're not seeing the sort of queerness all around them. So I'm hoping that the book can really help people to understand the sort of sustained and deep ways that queer people have really been involved in anti-war and anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist work for quite a long time.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with historian Emily Hobson about her book, Lavender and Red, Liberation and Solidarity in the Gay and Lesbian Left. How did the politics of gay and lesbian solidarity, politics of alliances, how did participation in all of those different alliances leave those gay and lesbian activists with lessons that were then harnessed with the arrival of AIDS?
Right. So this is the kind of the last chapter of the book looks at the rise of the AIDS direct action movement. And I initially was not sure what kinds of connections I would find. I knew that AIDS activism was clearly an important part of a kind of gay and lesbian left history, but I didn't really know how those connections would appear. And I was really struck and to some degree surprised, but then kind of on reflection not so surprised, to realize that Central American solidarity work and also anti-nuclear work were both really important influences on the AIDS direct action movement. And this, again, particularly comes through in the Bay Area, but also is something that marks the rise of AIDS direct action in other places around the U.S. So in San Francisco, the first AIDS direct action groups really modeled themselves very directly on anti-intervention protest tactics. For example, the first really kind of sustained group that ultimately turns into, kind of morphs into ACT UP San Francisco, the first group was called the AIDS Action Pledge. And it modeled itself directly on the Pledge of Resistance, which was a national network to involve people in civil disobedience against U.S. intervention in Central America. So by becoming involved in the Pledge of Resistance, a person would sign a pledge to engage in civil disobedience or to support those who did at moments of heightened U.S. intervention, U.S. invasion, or threatened invasion. And the Pledge of Resistance also drew a lot of people out in the Bay Area to engage in civil disobedience at, for example, sites of weapons testing and weapons shipment. And that was modeled on kind of tactics from the anti-nuclear movement. So people would go out to, for example, to Livermore, to kind of sites there and attempt to block shipments of white phosphorus to the government of El Salvador, these kinds of tactics. And the AIDS Action Pledge modeled itself very directly on that, and also a number of individuals who had been active in the Pledge of Resistance created the AIDS Action Pledge. So by signing the AIDS Action Pledge, you pledge to commit civil disobedience or to support those who did in order to stop the AIDS crisis and to call for federal funding and these kinds of goals. One of the things that's really interesting about these connections is, you know, usually we date the beginning of the AIDS direct action movement to ACT UP in New York. the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, which formed in March of 1987. And ACT UP was an absolutely really critical organization, but the AIDS Action Pledge actually formed before it. And there were also a number, even before the AIDS Action Pledge, a number of kind of shorter-lived efforts of direct action that, again, came out of Central American solidarity. So the very first two moments of civil disobedience to confront AIDS occurred in 1984 and 1985 in San Francisco, and they were directly kind of mentored by Central American solidarity work. Then there were a number of kind of shorter-lived organizations, Stand Together and Citizens for Medical Justice, that kind of drew some lessons out of Central American solidarity, and those then morphed into the AIDS Action Pledge, which formed in the summer of 1986, several months before ACT UP did. And again, the AIDS Action Pledge ultimately became ACT UP San Francisco because the ACT UP model out of New York, it really innovated and was incredibly important in its use of graphics, its engagement with art, its kind of use of art and visual messages as important elements of direct action protest. So it was the kind of visibility of ACT UP that became really important as kind of out of the New York model, and in part out of the very strong arts community of New York. But many of the very concrete tactics of civil disobedience and the kind of training and knowledge of how to engage civil disobedience came out of, again, Central American solidarity, anti-nuclear, other kinds of anti-militarist work. And there was a kind of moment when that radical genealogy was really recognized very early on in 1987, also in the a March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights in October of 1987, and a civil disobedience at the Supreme Court that was right after the march. So there was a kind of recognition that, you know, we learned these lessons from work against the war, and therefore this sort of helps us understand how AIDS is, AIDS activism is connected to anti-war activism, as well as the argument that we should take money to fund the fight against AIDS from the military budget, right? So these arguments also shaped the ways people thought about AIDS itself. But by the late 1980s, you know, 1989, 1990, that kind of awareness of radical history starts to kind of drop out of the AIDS direct action movement, in large part, I think, because many activists are themselves dying. So in the Bay Area in particular, there's a number of people who brought that kind of history from Central America work who were getting sick and dying right at the sort of moment of the depths of the AIDS crisis and the kind of at the moment in many ways in which they were needed most, right? They simply couldn't pass on those lessons because they themselves were being lost.
Let me end by asking you about the life cycle of these movements, and you've just touched on that in a really literal way, and what lessons you think can be drawn from gay and lesbian liberation, especially as it played out in the Bay Area and the radical alliances that it built. What lessons could be drawn from those experiences today?
So there's three big themes that I hope people really take away from the book: identity, geography, and genealogy. So the theme of identity is an argument that, you know, in direct opposition to the kind of notion that identity politics is a site of rigidity or separatism, or a site of kind of narrow conceptions of distinct forms of identity, that in fact identity holds power through affiliation, right? That one of the reasons identity is powerful is that we can always remake it, we can always redefine it. We're not, you know, just finding identity that exists, we're crafting it, we're expressing it. And so when we express, for example, a radical queer politics or, you know, a radical black politics or a radical Palestinian politics, you know, whatever it is, we are defining that identity through the analysis we present and also the affiliations we forge with other people. So it's this idea of identity as a site of potential affiliation. Geography comes through in the ways that the book tracks the connections between the local and the global or the international in the site of the Bay Area. Although the Bay Area is quite unique, I also would argue that the pattern that I see in the Bay Area of this connection between the local and the international is something that we can observe in a lot of different places, and that people can forge power through in a lot of different places that are particular to their own context. So, for example, if this same book was being written, you know, for Washington, D.C., we'd see stronger connections to the anti-apartheid movement because the anti-apartheid movement had some particular strength in D.C. If we're, you know, looking at it in New York, we'd see a lot of strong connections to Puerto Rican independence work and so on, right? There's different kinds of connections that are going to appear in different places. But that geography can be a site and a sort of a lens for thinking about interconnections between issues and communities. And then genealogy is this notion that by claiming our radical genealogies and our radical histories more broadly, we can understand some of the interconnections that have already been made in the past, the forms of solidarity that have already been created in the past, as well as use that kind of knowledge, right, for mentoring and passing on lessons and passing on skills in the present. So even though the book ends with a kind of moment of mourning, that so many activists in AIDS Direct Action were dying just at the moment that they were trying, you know, could have passed on lessons, and therefore this sort of possibility, gay and lesbian left possibility, kind of saw a moment of downturn, that we still can, you know, recapture that through, you know, some effort, some digging, some, you know, reading about and looking for sources and talking to each other kind of across generational lines and so forth, then we can use a sense of radical history to re-energize our work in the present.
Emily Hobson, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me a chance to talk about the book.
I've been speaking with the author of Lavender and Red, Liberation and Solidarity in the Gay and Lesbian Left. That's published by the University of California Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Emily Hobson is Assistant Professor of History and of Gender, Race, and Identity at the University of Nevada, Reno. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.